I think we're going to have to get started. It's just a little over our scheduled start time. We have a distinguished panel here today, and then there's me. So we're going to talk about correlation in loss reserves. Correlation is a very crucial topic, especially if you're talking about aggregating risk up to the enterprise level, what correlates and what doesn't really, and how much they correlate is really a controlling thing. So it's really a crucial thing, hard to get a handle on. Is this, this sounds very like it's loud and echoing. Is it doing that? How do we avoid it making, how do we avoid having it do that? It's not too bad? Okay.
The gentleman in the back of the room says it's great.
Okay, good enough. So in any case, a crucial topic, the title of the session is happens to be the same as the title of Gerald Kirshner's recent paper in Variance called Two Approaches to Calculating Correlated Reserve Indications. They made up the title. He was the only panelist, so that's why it's the title of the session. But I think Gerald's going to focus on one of them. So if Glenn does something about correlating within the triangle and I just give you one, it'll still be two. So that should be okay. Gerald is one of the authors of that paper. If you haven't read the paper, it's very well written. It's don't need a math PhD to read it, so I recommend it to you. I'm going to let Gerald introduce himself because we didn't get around to writing introductions. So here's Gerald Kirshner going to talk about a real practical spreadsheet kind of thing you can do to correlate reserves across lines of business.
I've already scared off one of my co-speakers, so we're doing really, really well. and if I start coughing, I'll try to move away from the microphone quickly because I'm trying to get over a cold, so hopefully I won't kill you with booming, echoing coughs in here. Anyway, I'm Jerry Kirshner. I'm a senior manager with Deloitte Consulting. I've been with Deloitte almost 5 years now. And the paper that I wrote and published in Variance was actually a paper that I had originally written back about 2002, this was an area that I've obviously had an interest in for a while, and really what I was trying to do was think about ways of approaching, coming up with some fairly simple, practical approaches to dealing with multiple lines of business, and how can you try to understand what the correlation or the impacts of correlation between those lines of business might be. There are a couple things on my paper that I'm not going to talk about, one of which Glenn will in his conversation, which is trying to understand, well, first of all, I guess I focus on issues between lines of business. Glenn's going to talk a little bit about looking at some correlation issues within a line of business. So there's so that's one area that Glenn will cover that I'm not going to cover. But there's probably a couple of other areas that could be talked about that I'm going to bypass over as well, because I'm either going to say that they're not relevant to what I'm exactly talking about, or I don't have good answers for them, whichever way you want to think about it. That's what this presentation is not. I'm not going to talk about how you simulate reserve ranges for a single line of business. There's a lot of conversations, a lot of papers, a lot of other discussions that can talk about that. I'm going to assume here that we know how to do that and we're able to do that. I'm also not going to talk about things that are relevant, or at least to what I think are relevant for enterprise risk management or capital adequacy, because I'm thinking about this from the perspective of coming up with ranges of reserves. If I were an opining actuary, what is a range of reasonable reserves? And as such, I'm not going to be looking to understand what is the implications at the 99th percentile of a distribution or the very extreme ends. So some of the things that are relevant at the very extreme ends, I personally don't think are as much of a concern in the more middle ground that you would be looking at when you're coming up with a reasonable reserve range. So those things, but tails are things that are very relevant to enterprise risk management, capital adequacy. They might require different techniques than what I'm going to talk about here. Oh, and by the way, I have no problems with anyone stopping me anywhere along the line and asking questions, so that if you have a question, stop me. If it's something that seems like it's going to get lengthy, I will possibly ask you to defer to either the end or afterwards, but we'll at least give it a shot as we go along. So first, a quick question, comment on conversation about correlation versus causality. Ideally, we would be able to address issues between lines of business through an understanding of the underlying causal relationships, but that's not always possible. There's a lot of different moving parts in our world that we can't necessarily quantify and bring into a reserving model. So because we can't, we have to deal with it through correlation, i.e. strength of relationships, and try to say we don't know what the underlying causal effect is, but we can at least deal with the resulting outcomes. And, you know, I asked for another comment, is that the strength of the relationship for strength of correlation really isn't relevant if we're only looking at the mean, the average value of the distributions between a couple of lines of business. But it does matter when we're looking towards the ends of the distribution. But even then, it really doesn't matter all that much if either your lines of business don't have a lot of variability between them or the correlations aren't very strong. Example that I put up right here is, let's suppose we had two lines of business. Actually, I just took two distributions from a normal distribution with a mean of 100, standard deviation of 25, and I just randomly sampled from the two of them. And then I said, what would be the sum, you know, if I took those two lines of business and tried to come up with the aggregate, the combined range outcomes for those value for those two lines of business at the 75th percentile. If there was no correlation, I'd have a value of 223. Obviously, the mean would be 200. So at the 75th percentile, with no correlation, we're talking about a value of 223. If I increase the correlations to the point that they're perfectly correlated, that value at the 75th percentile goes up to 233.7, a 4% increase. So in reality, you very rarely have a situation where you have two lines of business that are 100% correlated with one another. So in this example, what it says is, at least says to me, is that, you know, if I don't have a lot of variability and I don't have a super strong correlation, trying to worry about how much the impact of correlation is going to be isn't going to change my end result all that much. But if we take a look at this and say, suppose we start increasing that standard deviation from 25 to 200. So now I've got a normal distribution with mean of 100, standard deviation of 200. That would be the far right column down here. Now instead of having, you know, the value at the 75th percentile for a no correlation condition in this case is now just over 390. But now if I start increasing the strength of the correlations, you start seeing that now the numbers start to become substantially larger. So now we're talking about, you know, at the 50% correlation, the number is not 390, it's 11% larger than that. So again, part of the exercise, what you have to think about is, How much variability is there, and how strong is the correlations? So I proposed two methodologies in my paper for trying to quantify correlation. The first one makes you, the user, do some work. You've got to specify a correlation matrix. I'm not going to tell you how to make that correlation matrix up. I'm going to leave that to you. You might say that's actually the hard part, and I would agree. But nonetheless, I'm going to leave that up to you. Paul Bream wrote a paper back about 2002 also where he was using Ben Zenworth's Ikerfus model and was proposing in that paper a couple of ways to try to come up with a correlation matrix. There's also been a number of other papers written that talk about options for that as well. As I said, I'm going to leave some of the hard stuff to you guys. I'll just say that if you have it, how could you use it to quantify what the numerical value of that correlation is? And I'm going to do that through using rank correlation. The second method will be using a bootstrap process, which does not require you to come up with your own correlation matrix. It'll just use the information implicit in the data itself in order to help you understand how two lines of business might be correlated or might be related to one another. So first one, and just give a quick example of what is rank correlation. I assume we all know this, but I'll just go over very quickly as well. Suppose I've got two lines of business, A and B, and I've gave five random draws from each of them. So these are over here on my left are my five random draws. If A and B have perfect inverse correlation, what I would do is I would sort A from high to low and B from low to high and add the two numbers together. If they were no correlation, I could just take the random draws exactly as they are and add the two of them together to get my combined result. If they're perfectly correlated, I would sort A from low to high and B from low to high and then add the results together. So at the end of the day, in a perfectly inverse correlated result, your range is the narrowest, perfectly correlated it's the widest, and no correlation it's randomly somewhere in the middle. So this is This rank correlation is going to be one of the key things that I use in my method one. And so there's about 9 steps, and I'll go over the 9 steps, and then I'll go back and walk through them a little more slowly, with some examples of some Excel formulas that can be used to actually make this work. So the first thing we're going to do is, again, we're going to start by generating N reserve indications from each line of business on a standalone basis. Remember, this is one of the things I told you I wasn't going to tell you how to do. I'm going to assume that you already knew how to do this one. So we've got these N reserve indications. We're going to sort them from low to high. And then we're going to develop the correlation matrix through whatever other means, magic, judgment, whatever you want to call it. And we're going to enter that correlation information into a correlation matrix that needs to be symmetric and positive definite. We need the correlation matrix to be that so that we can use Cholesky decomposition to create the lower triangular matrix from the original correlation matrix. And then we're going to generate a whole other series of random variables. But this time we're going to generate them from just a normal 0-1 distribution. So we're going to generate as many observations as we need to match up with the reserve indications that we generated from our method, from our first step one. So if I have suppose I was doing an analysis which involved creating 5,000 different possible results from my reserve simulation, I would then generate 5,000 random values from my normal 0-1 distribution as well. What I would do is I would then combine the random values across my multiple lines of business to produce N vectors. So in this case, I have 5,000 vectors of random numbers drawn from this normal 0-1 distribution. If I multiply that with my Cholesky decomposed lower triangular matrix, I will end up producing N correlated normal vectors. I'll then want to rank the value of each of those correlated normal results to identify which of my original 5,000 random draws I want to combine from lines 1, 2, 3, whatever, to be able to create my final correlated reserve indications. So we'll just take that go back step by step and go a little slower this time. First thing we do is we start with a correlation matrix. The correlation matrix is going to be square, and where the entries are mirror images of one another. So if you've got this one, like the 0.9912 over here is mirrored down here. The 0.9 is mirrored over here, 0.9. This example has obviously some very high correlations. Not to say that your correlation matrix would have numbers that were this high, but that's what we just did for this example. So then we want to make sure that the matrix is positive definite. One way that we can test for it is if we calculate the determinant of this matrix. And you can do that using a simple Excel function, mdeterm. And it'll just tell you what the determinant of this matrix is. And it's not necessarily, it's not enough technically to have a positive determinant, to have a positive definite matrix, but you can't be positive definite without a positive determinant. So, at least gives you, the process for determining whether a matrix is positive definite or not is a little more complicated than just calculating the determinant of it. So this might be a shortcut that you can do in one simple Excel step to at least make sure that your matrix has the positive determinant that you need. Okay. So then we've generated. So now suppose we've got 6 loss reserve indications for 3 lines of business. Here they are. They're just all, this is our random generation of them. So first thing we want to do is we want to rank them. And so we figure out what their ranking order is right there. And then we restate them so that they're ranked from low to high. Okay, so far, pretty easy. And then suppose we build our correlation matrix. That's symmetric and positive definite. We can decompose that matrix into its lower triangular matrix L using Cholesky's decomposition. And then once we have that, we then generate, as I said, since we had 6 different random values or potential reserve numbers, I now generate 6 independent randomly generated numbers from a normal 0-1 distribution. And then I just combine them across the 3 lines of business, so now I've got 6 uncorrelated vectors, 1 to 6. multiplying the Cholesky decomposed lower triangular matrix with each of those vectors is going to produce 6 correlated normal vectors. Something like that. So we're going to use those 6 correlated normal vectors as the basis for then figuring out what their ranking is, and that's going to tell me how to go back to that first matrix that I had where I ranked everyone, and know which particular values to pull together to come up with my correlated indications 1 through 6. So this is the conclusion of it. A little more math, a little more beautiful PowerPoint artwork there. So what this is telling me now is that, again, this had a correlation matrix that had very high correlations. So in this case, it makes a lot of sense that the lowest values for one line of business are most likely going to be combined with the lowest values for another line of business. So in this particular example, I've got the lowest of the first two lines being combined with the second lowest of the third line. The result being that I end up with my correlated result going anywhere from 21,100 all the way up to a high of 66,600. So what this has done is this has allowed me to use that correlation matrix information plus the information I created on the individual line of business level to bring it together using some pretty simple Excel equations to come up with a correlated reserve indication across the multiple lines of business. Questions on that one? Okay, so let's move into bootstrapping. Before I go into the bootstrapping method, I'm just going to do a brief refresher of how bootstrapping works, because the mathematics of bootstrapping are what will enable me to do the second method. So first thing we do in a bootstrapping is we have we've got a cumulative data history, cumulative triangle right here of actual data. What we can do is we can combine we want to essentially create a recast historical cumulative data set that basically relies on the average link ratios to backfill what the observations would have been had those average link ratios been accurate at every point in time. From that, we can then convert that recast triangle into incremental data. From that, we then create a series of residuals, or the differences between the actual incremental data and this recast incremental data. And those residuals are going to be, when we use the bootstrapping, the residuals determine how we, the variability with which we're going to create our samples, our false histories of what could possibly happen in each of the different bootstrap simulations. So what we do is we take a random draw from the residuals, and we then combine the random draws with the recast history to come up with a false history, a random history that basically brings into play the randomness that we saw in the original data set to come up with this false history. Once we have our false history, we can then just use traditional actuarial techniques, square the triangle, whatever, to come up with our ultimate. So a bunch more steps to follow. Not going to talk about those here. What I do want to point out here is that the important piece here is how to use those residuals across multiple lines of business in order to be able to come up with what I would call a correlated range of variability. And the way I propose to do that is, within the bootstrap process, we have this triangle of residuals for each line of business. And they're used to create the variations in the ultimate losses, as I just showed you. Well, what happens if instead of just pulling them randomly for each of the multiple lines of business, I pull them in a manner that's consistent? And I'm going to call that my correlated bootstrap. So, for example, what's happening is, in an uncorrelated sense, I'm going to just randomly sample from my residuals. And they're going to be whatever they are. There's random samples. But they're not necessarily going to be the same between my first line of business and my second line of business. But in my correlated state, they would be. So whatever residual I pull from the one line of business, I pull the corresponding residual from the other line of business. My argument here is that whatever underlying process, environment, whatever it was that caused the variability in the first line of business was causing some level of variability in the second line of business. And therefore, if they are related, looking at the residuals, the same set of residuals in their respective bootstrap processes should bring the same amount, same underlying causal relationships together in my derivation of ultimate losses across the different lines of business. The same placement. So, like, I've got a I have one triangle of residuals from this line of business and one triangle of residuals from that line of business. I pick one at random, and it's somewhere within the triangle. It's a cell, exactly. It's a cell in the triangle. I want to pick the exact same cell from the other triangle as to use for the residual that I use coming up with the bootstrap for the second line of business. So that, as opposed to just picking them, you know, completely randomly. Okay. But if I do that, my argument is that you should be using the same. Whatever caused the variability in the one is causing variability in the other. Therefore, they should be related. And then you're running each bootstrap simulation sort of independently, but you're picking the same residuals, the residual positions from across the multiple lines the same way, so that you've got your say two lines of business. You've got your two bootstrap simulation processes running along here. In the middle is when you pick the residuals. In an uncorrelated state, you would pick the residuals here completely randomly or separately from the residuals you would pick here. But because you're now picking them from the same, using the same cells, the end result of the bootstrap simulation reflects the correlations underlying causal relationships affecting the two lines of business at the same time, in the same way, in the history. So where does that leave us? The end result is that there are a couple of pros and cons of each approach. Correlation matrix pros, it's more flexible. You're not limited by the data that you're observing. But you do have to do the additional hard work of coming up with your correlation matrix. Bootstrap, you don't need to do that, but you've got the limitations of the data that you've got to work with. So I did a quick case. So I did a little case study. Had three lines of business, and they're all about the same level of reserve indications, but with different levels of volatility around the mean. I did 5,000 simulations, and I just wanted to see how the models resulted. What I found was that doing my first approach, my rank correlation, I said, I don't know what the right level of correlation is, so I'm going to try it with a couple of different levels, 0, 25, 50%, 75%, and 100% correlation to see how the reserve ranges, you know, how the values changed at the 75th percentile. And I ended up showing that there was about, at the 75th percentile, there's about 3% increase over the 0% correlation result. So then I added the bootstrap results in, and I said, where does the bootstrap come out? What does the bootstrap can maybe tell me about my correlation? The bootstrap came in with a number of about 2.5%. So what I said is, means that if I can believe my bootstrap, that means I'm somewhere between the 25 and 50% correlation condition. So it's a way of helping me understand how strong my correlation matrix should be. It doesn't tell me exactly what the value should be in the correlation matrix, but it does give me a way of testing and evaluating whether what I think is my a priori correlations make any sense at all. So at the end of the day, what it does is the bootstrap does tell me that in this example that there do seem to be some correlations in the underlying data. And it's at least worth considering that in coming up with my combined reserve indications across the multiple lines of business. So that's it. So just to conclude my piece, the aggregate reserve you obviously want to be able to understand the dependencies between the underlying lines of business. And if the lines of business that you're working with aren't volatile, don't have a lot of variability, don't have a lot of correlation, you may not need to worry about this, but if the lines of business that you're working with do have volatility and you do think the correlations are high, then this is something that you may want to consider in trying to come up with your aggregated reserve results. That's the end of mine. So we can hold our applause till the end. next up is going to be Glenn, I believe. So I'll get this set up for Glenn. There you are.
Okay, introducing myself a bit. I'm Glenn Myers. I've been with ISO for the past 20 years. Before that, I was a professor of actuarial science at University of Iowa. Over the years, I've been on a number of committees and so forth, but basically what it boils down to is I talk at CAS meetings a lot. I write a lot of papers, so it's really what it boils down to. Okay. What I want to look at in terms of correlation is that I want to take a look at what I will call drivers of correlation or causes of correlation. I want to start off with just a very simple example. Suppose you have two random variables, x1 and x2. You can think of them as losses. I usually do. And then you select some random variables, what I'll call b1, b2, and b at random. Okay. Now, it turns out right here that b1 times x1 and b2 times x2 are not correlated, but if we multiply both x1 and x2 by the same b, okay, we can see that there's something in there that's making good things and bad things happen at the same time. And in a sense right there, that sort of drives the idea of correlation. Okay, now what I'm going to do right here is that I took, x's, which were gamma distributed, and I took the b1 x1 and the b2 x2 and plotted them against each other. And now if I use the common b in there, that'll be in the right-hand graph, the blue one, you will see that you can begin to see how this common b generates what we normally think of as correlation. Now, what happens is that the yellow one right here, this was driven from it's the sum of the B1 X1 and B2 X2. And you actually just get a histogram of the sum, whereas if you were to do it when you multiply the B by the common B, you can see that these were exactly the same X1s and X2s. And you can see where the B's make the losses spread out a little bit more. Okay, and since we are interested in the sum of losses, okay, this is exactly why, correlation should matter to us. Okay, now I want to go into a stochastic loss reserve model, and it's going to be virtually the same model I did my call paper on, which I presented yesterday. Okay. Suppose we have X, which has subscripts for the accident year and settlement lag, is the loss paid in a given cell. Now, what you have right here is you want the expected value to be some kind of a function of the premium and the expected loss ratio and two parameters that I'll call A and B. For those of you who attended my session yesterday, this is what we call the beta model. And essentially, A and B are parameters of the beta distribution. Now then, what we have here is we want to, from this, generate a distribution of X's from the collective risk model. Now, the collective risk model, it comes from, it's basically, think of it as a simulation of first you grab a random number of claim counts, and then you, for each claim, you grab a random loss amount and add up everything. That's essentially the collective risk model. Now, we're actually, since we're going to be looking at losses in a triangle, we're going to be doing several different collective risk models all at once. Okay? So now the count distribution, if you were to select the counts independently in each cell, they would be, I took them from a negative binomial distribution. But now one of the things I will mention as we go on a little bit further, if you take some of the claim counts all at once from multiple cells at once, there's something called a negative multinomial distribution that can happen here. And I'll be getting into that as we know, because the negative multinomial is part of what drives, okay, the correlation. Now, the other property we have of this is that we have the claim severity distribution increasing with settlement lags. And this, I think, corresponds to the general intuition for most lines okay, that the small claims are settled earlier and the bigger ones take a while to settle. Okay, now in this loss reserve model, I'm going to take a look at what we call the expected loss model, which says that the expected value of a particular cell is going to be the premium that corresponds to the accident year, the expected loss ratio, and a paid development factor. In other words, the proportion of losses that are paid within a given lag. So these are parameters. But now what we do is we get the development for that particular lag in terms of basically the beta distribution. And now we're using the beta distribution has a curve here. In other words, so what happens is that if we take a look at the lag, if you look at the cumulative beta going from 0 up to 10, right there, and then you take the lag minus 1. So in other words, it's the difference in the cumulative is the way we are getting these development factors. Okay? Now, the negative binomial model for claim count, it has a very, my sense is that most actuaries understand the negative binomial, but let me sort of go through it here for those of you who haven't taken, part 3 or 4 for a while. We start off with an expected claim count for each accident year and settlement lag. And then we select a random variable for each accident year and lag from a gamma distribution with mean 1 and variance C. Now, then if you let the claim count itself for the cell be Poisson with mean, which is going to be that random variable from the great gamma distribution times the overall mean, that is what generates, okay, the negative binomial distribution. And it turns out right here that, you know, if you do this independently, the claim counts will be independent for all settlement lags and accident years. Now, for the negative multinomial, I'm going to be doing something a little different here. I'm going to be selecting that same random multiplier from a gamma distribution, and it's going to be the same random multiplier for every settlement lag in the accident year. Okay? Now, it turns out right here that for any given cell, we still have a negative binomial distribution. But what happens is that the overall, when you look at all cells together, you will see that the claim counts are correlated within a given accident year, and they're independent between each accident year. Now, what we want to do is we want to use this negative, these models right here to predict the distribution of outcomes. Now, the model we've constructed right here predicts the distribution for each settlement lag and accident year. And now we need to find the sum over all the future payments that will be made here. And so in other words, what we're doing is we're wanting to find the distribution of the sum of all the things in the triangle, part of the triangle we haven't seen yet. That's what we're trying to calculate from the model. And there's nice mathematics that enable you to do this fairly efficiently that I became familiar with very early in my actuarial career. Okay, so in other words, I think I just got ahead of myself here, but we need to get the distribution of sum. We need to consider the correlations, or the way we've done this, we need to consider the structure of the drivers of correlation. Now, the way I do these things is I use fast Fourier transforms. And what's good about fast Fourier transforms is it takes the mathematically difficult process of finding, okay, the distribution of the sum of two random variables, and it says, basically, you can do this by just simply multiplying the transforms. Okay, it's a very handy gadget, and it involves, you know, all kinds of things like complex numbers and so forth, but it does work. Okay, now, if these have a dependence right here, you can't just multiply, but what you have to do right here is you've got to take, okay, the expected value over some kind, over all the possible values of your driver, which I specify by theta here, the conditional distributions for a given theta. Conditional for a given theta, they're independent. So you can do the multiplying of the transforms. Okay? But then if you take the average over all possible values of theta, you can then get, okay, the distribution of the sum of random variables. Very nice little thing. And it gets more interesting as we move on. Okay, now the example that I'm going to be given here, I've got a variance paper. I think this is in the same issue of variance that Jerry's papers is in, called Estimating Predictive Distribution from Loss Reserve Models. And this is sort of typical of that. I have, you know, basically $50 million of premium, claim severity, distributions given, contagion parameter, expected loss ratio, A and B. So this is the example I'm going to be given. And now, if you take a look right here at the negative binomial, okay, that is essentially the red distribution, and you work out the distribution of the sums of the outstanding losses here. What you're going to see right here is that it is a higher peak and it's shorter tail. And the yellow one has the negative multinomial in it, and essentially that's got a somewhat thicker tail. And so we can see that the correlation here, you know, within the accident years, you know, makes a difference. Now, again, right here, the choice of the ELR and the A and B parameters also affects all the X's and AY lags. And so a good estimation procedure provides a distribution of the possible estimates. That is was in the paper that I presented right here, is that we use this thing called the Gibbs sampler, which is a way of generating a parameter set from the posterior distribution. It's actually... It's a tricky thing to implement, but the idea is that it does this thing. And it's the random parameters that derive the correlation. Now here, what I did is that I generated the histograms of the parameters, of each of the parameters from this. And here's just a sample of the way these things are sort of spread out. You know, we've got the ELR, we've got the histogram of A, the histogram of B, and what I did is I combined the A and B to translate that into development paths. Okay, now with the negative, so when we do this right here, when we apply the negative multinomial model, we can see we get the light blue distribution, and with the negative binomial model, this is a negative multinomial model both ways. And one, okay, it contains the parameter risk that generates from the Gibbs sampler. And that's the yellow one without the parameter risk and the blue one with the parameter risk. So we can actually see right here when we just consider the randomness of the parameters and the fact that our parameters themselves are random variables, you got to take that, and that also helps drive correlation. Okay, now... I think when I got recruited to do this, I was thinking about, you know, the within year. I was thinking about the within year correlation, and then we found out that we want to talk about two-year correlation. So I thought I better at least throw a couple examples like this. And suppose we just sort of treat the above have two separate lines, two pretty much identical lines, but sometimes we want to treat them independently, sometimes... or simultaneously. And here's the way we get the distributions from them. And when we combine two identical lines, we can see, again, right here, we can see the difference in the distributions that result when you do this. Okay, the orange one is the independent sum, and the Yellow one is the paired parameter sum. So we can see that correlation can come from a number of what I would call common drivers. Now, I spent a lot of time right there dealing with the idea of managing capital. Jerry tried to skip that, but I'm going to talk about it a little. Okay. Now, suppose what we wanted to do right here is we wanted to, calculate various statistics based on the distribution of outcomes here. And if you wanted to get the capital that comes from a standard deviation formula, which would be 2.576 times a standard deviation, that's one way to calculate capital. Another way that we may want to calculate, the capital would be to use the tail value at risk, which is going to be the tail value at risk at 99% minus the expected value. So these are two different ways of calculating the capital. Now, so what I did right there is I had a bunch of different models with different correlation structures. If you started off with the same model here, and you take with the negative binomial and fixed parameters, you can see that you have I'll go with the T-var capital because I really like that better. 18.51 is a T-var capital. Now, if I basically say, okay, we're going to have correlation within an accident year and the correlation is between the various settlement lags. If we take that into account, that TVAR capital turns out to be 21.5. Okay, now if what we do right here is I take the parameters that result from, the Gibbs sampler, and we use those parameters as we do it, we up the capital necessary for this example to 25. Okay? Now, then I go down to two lines of insurance. Okay? And again, right there, these are two identical lines. If I were to take a random sum of the two lines, not really trying to pair them, I have a capital of about 35. But when I do a paired sum, in other words, I choose the same, parameters from the Gibbs sampler for each line of insurance, that, basically affects the capital and moves it up to about over 40. Okay, so considering this in any kind of capital management things, correlation is a very important thing to do. And essentially, if you take the kind of things that I do in, the paper, and probably any of our stochastic loss reserving papers, if you structure the correlation the right sort of way, what you can do is actually take that into account when you combine lines, combine parts of triangles within a line. And I think that's it. So, Spencer, you're on. And I want to watch your presentation, so.
Okay. Just help me find where it is.
Yeah. One more time to get through it. And this one is you.
Okay.
There you go.
I think I'll do it with them off. Thank you. I'm going to be getting back to the cross line of business correlation issue. I'm Spencer Gluck. I work for Guy Carpenter Instrat. I've spent the, I'm not going to go through my whole career, I've been around a long time, I've spent a lot of the last year slaving over building a loss reserve variability model that would do all the things I always wanted to do. And so I'm going to tell you a little about that, and the idea of cross lines correlation is one of the issues that I can approach, and of course that's going to be more of the focus of this session. But first, I just want to, talk a little about some general issues because I have a different approach. It's related to some other modeling work that some other people are doing. But I think that a big focus in general, now as we've moved as a profession from making estimates to estimating distributions to modeling, is validity of models, okay? And what that means is that now you're saying a lot more then this is my best estimate. Now you're saying there's this whole probabilistic structure within my model, and I'm going to rely on that to help me understand the distribution of possible outcomes. And, of course, validity means that this entire probabilistic structure that described really describes or reasonably describes the thing it's supposed to describe. Now, of course, the real world that we deal with is a very complex thing. Everything we're looking at, a triangle that goes into the triangle, and we know whatever model we come into is a vast simplification of that. So you can't have perfect validity. But it's an extremely important issue. If the model really isn't plausibly valid, then all these probabilistic conclusions you're making out of it, you don't even know what they mean, because if the model is not describing the same reality as that you're looking at. So there's a lot of assumptions inside these models, but let's focus down to what I think the most important thing is. What all these models do is they say somewhere out there, there's some structure to what happens. There's the systematic structure, and then after we measure and correct for the systematic structure, what's left over is random. And then we are using that randomness to describe the process. So the things that we describe as random have to be random. There are other assumptions about them as well. Whether they're independent is important, and the shape of the distributions. But most important, are they random? Is there something systematic going on that we haven't modeled? Because if there is something that you can see, it's systematic, it's going on, and it's not in your model, then that means your model doesn't really describe an important thing in the process. So who knows what those forecast distributions really mean. And the most common way to do that is to look at residual plots. The residuals, after you fit this model, is what's left over. These are the things that are supposed to be random and independent. And so you look at them. There are statistical tests, but the eyeball tests are often the most important ones. So I'm going to come back to that theme, and it really has to do with, does my model reflect the real world it's supposed to reflect? Okay, now let's talk about that same common sense idea about, before we talk about cross-lines correlations, why do we think there is, you know, we all think it must be there, but why? Why should reserve uncertainty, reserve risk, be correlated across the lines? And I have basically, in my mind, two drivers. The first set of drivers is the most important thing, and I'm calling them common systemic processes, non-diversifying processes. I like to make the important here because we often talk about process risk and parameter risk and model risk, and this is, in my mind, really a process risk, but it's not the one we're usually thinking about. It's kind of at the end. It is a process risk, like a natural catastrophe is a process risk. It's a process that hits a lot of things at the same time. So these are systemic processes, like general inflation. If the inflation rate goes up, any line of business reserves that are exposed to it, they're going to go up altogether. The second bullet is often the most important one. It's not just general inflation. It's claims inflation, which sometimes we call it social inflation or superimposed inflation. That will hit more than one line of business, or might hit more than one line of business at the same time, affecting all your reserves. Of course, in casualty, there are other things like latent exposures, you know, the big other kinds of casualty shocks and disasters that come out. So those, I'm calling those things common processes, but they're systemic, meaning more they're systemic, so they don't diversify, and they're process risks, meaning you can't estimate them away. This is a risk of something that's going to happen in the future or that may happen in the future that crosses your lines. Now, the other thing comes down to estimation error, which we sometimes call parameter risk, or really it's a combination of parameter and modeling risk. Why would that be correlated across lines of business? Well, if you're thinking about the IBNR reserves at your company, there may be common philosophy, common assumptions that are made across the lines of business, but of course you don't see that in the triangles. In the triangles, though, there may be effects of other common practices. You know, we have paid things, so what if payment practices, settlement practices change in the company, and what if they change simultaneously in different lines of business? And, of course, case reserve adequacy, if you're relying on incurred methods, we all know about worrying about changes in case reserve adequacy, and they could cross lines of business. And what all of the things on this page have in common, which is what I've had in the bold at the bottom, is when do they happen and what do they look like? They look like things that happen in calendar time. They happen in a calendar year. If you're looking at your history, they happen on the diagonal of the triangle. And if you're looking in the future, they may happen on those diagonals of future things. They tend to be calendar year things. So what about these chain ladder consistent models? I'm talking about reserve adequacy models, but I'm talking about the chain ladder. Well, one of them is the Mach model. You know what that one is. The other one you know too, but I hate the name. So I named it, I'm calling it the MFE/ODP, which it sounds down there in the bottom is the multiple fixed effects over dispersed Poisson model. That's the one from the England and Verrall paper that people go around calling bootstrapping. We've got to stop calling that bootstrapping. It's like calling the method standard deviation. Bootstrapping is just a statistical technique. It's not telling you what model you're applying it to. Bootstrapping can be applied to any model. I use bootstrapping on a different model. So it's not bootstrapping. Multiple fixed effects really means the incremental losses are described as an accident year factor times a development pattern factor, two fixed effects, and the errors that are left over or the cells, the independent paid losses, are described by an over-dispersed Poisson distribution. So it's the MFE-ODP. I could call it England and Verrall, but I don't think they are the first ones to have come up with it. They've popularized the bootstrapping approach. So there it is. Sorry, you have it. What's the problem with all of that stuff? Calendar year effects. I said it's the most important thing causing correlation. There is no place in those models to recognize that such a thing even exists. It's basically like a chain ladder. Doesn't exist. You can't model it. Now, there is increasing interest, and I've seen on some of the titles of the other sessions, of looking at models for validity. Does your model fit? The problem is we don't have any answers if it doesn't. It's great if it does, but what if it doesn't? If you look at it and you look at it in the calendar year, you're going to find it frequently doesn't fit. And so there's no answers. So we've got to deal with a calendar year effect, and I've been talking about this for years. Okay, second bullet, I said it before. If there's a pattern not modeled, like a calendar year follow, then we have an invalid model, invalid predicted distributions. You just can't really say anything statistical about what they mean if the model is significantly invalid. So now, what about correlating the residuals? Now, this actually is related to the second method that Gerald just showed you, which if I don't like the chain ladder, I don't like it either. If the model is valid, the residuals should be random. That's the point. There shouldn't be high residuals in one part of the triangle and low residuals in another part of the triangle. If something like that's happening and you can see it, it means you have an invalid model. So that shouldn't even be there. Now you have triangles from different models, but there is the same underlying losses like a net and a gross triangle from the same data business. Well, there the random residuals should be correlated in that case because it's the exact same claims in both triangles. It's not that they're high in one position or another. So there you could see it, but most of the time we're talking about different lines of business and classic clash claims where my workers' comp insured gets involved in an accident with my auto insured are fairly uncommon. So if the triangles come from different incident events and they're both valid good models, the residuals just shouldn't be correlated. Now, what if there's an unrecognized trend, because these models in both of the client triangles you're looking at, and it's not modeled in either place because you don't have the ability to model? Well, then, and let's say the two unrecognized trends in the two lines of business are correlated with each other. Well, then you're going to have a failure to fit in similar places in the triangle, and you will see correlation. And if you do the kind of thing that's been recommended, you're going to get some correlation, and you may be getting kind of a valid correlation for valid reasons. But the problem is you don't have valid models, and so you don't have predictive distributions that are much use. But you haven't gotten a reading on correlation. Two models that don't recognize trends, if their residuals are correlated, they can tell you that there are correlated trends unrecognized in those two models. I think it might be better to recognize the trends and then have a valid model and use that same correlation. Okay, so what am I doing? I have some math slides. I'm probably not going to spend enough time on them to give you a time to digest them. They're kind of here for documentation. I'll just say them quickly. I start out with the same parameter structure that Barnett and Zenworth have been using for years. I think they call it the something trend family of models. Probabilistic trend family, that's what they call it. They made another presentation here about it. It's in the software package called ICRFIS, and the basic structure looks like this. It's multiplicative. Basically, you have an accident year scale parameter. The way the model is written is just the family, so it has a lot more parameters than they really are. So I have a different scale parameter for every accident year, just like the chain ladder has. then I describe the development pattern as a series, as if it were a trend. So I have a series of individual incremental to incremental development factors called DYK. And I also describe the calendar year trend. So I have a series of year-to-year calendar year trend factors, which I call CYL. You can't really have all those parameters. And one of the advantages of the model is that, in fact, when I say AYI is one parameter for every accident year, maybe it's just one parameter. Maybe I don't really need them to be different, because what I model is losses per exposure. So if I divide all the incremental losses by the exposures and I correct for the trends, then it's plausible that the expected loss per exposure should be the same number everywhere, and I only need one parameter. Depends on how good my exposures are. And it's the same thing with all the others. I don't necessarily need a different trend factor for every pair of calendar years. I might just need one calendar year trend factor for the whole period, or maybe there was a significant change in trend in the middle and I need two. Even in the development direction, you actually get to save a lot of parameters. You don't need 20 parameters for a 20-year development pattern, because a lot of these things chain together. So another good thing about this family is it can be very parsimonious, give you a way to save parameters. But the most important thing is the calendar year. That's what it does that the other models won't do. The calendar year parameters are the key. So when you change them when necessary, you can get the model crucial features of the data. You can also differentiate between calendar year effects and pricing effects. But my third bullet point comes to where I've tried to add something on to the previous work in this area. Sometimes, and frequently, if you do this model, a lot of times you realize you have to put in changes in calendar year trend. It's not always consistent. So from a probabilistic and a risk standpoint, you say, wait a minute, that allows me to model the past accurately, but what about the future? If calendar year trends sometimes change in the past, doesn't that mean that there's a risk that they will change in the future? And in fact, I believe, once you get down to it, that in our world is the number one loss reserve risk, and we're not even modeling it. It's the risk of calendar year things that will happen unpredictably in the future. They will be non-diversifying, and they will be a major reason, if not the major reason, why there's cross-lines correlations, because calendar year trends may change in the future, and it may be correlated. But this is more than theoretical, because I'm going to use industry data, and I have examples here for you. Okay, quickly, I've been doing all this modeling work, so I don't want to go on without saying that it's not just the Barnett-Zenworth model. I have made a number of changes. They use a log linear model, but I've used the ODP distribution, which I think is better. It has a better variance structure, and it allows zero. I'm modeling incremental paid losses. I can't have negative values, but I sure can have zero values, and zero values are important. And when you get a number near zero, it shouldn't be an extreme outlier when zero is a plausible result, especially in the tail. I have a model with paid and outstanding losses, not incurred losses, but paid and outstanding in a single model. There have been two other presentations about people looking into that. That's an increasing source of interest, and I think I've got the first approach that does it within this parametric trend family. So we can deal with trends, I can deal with paid and outstanding losses, and even make natural adjustments for when there's case reserve strengthening and weakening on the calendar year, because it's all built into the model. But I'm not going to even show you that part here. I just wanted to tell you that I have it. There's this thing about parameter smoothing that I have to get into. The accident year parameters can be smoothed with a Kalman filter, which I'm going to explain to you a little bit, but more conceptually. And that was always in Barnett and Zenworth's work. But what I have added is a calendar year smoothing, same kind of idea on the calendar year trends using a first order autoregressive process. And that provides not only that you can smooth the parameters, which is useful for the past, but now I'm trying to get into this issue of describing a probabilistic structure for those future calendar year trends, which I'm going to keep telling you is the biggest risk in our business. At least natural catastrophes and things aside. Maybe as big as that. Okay, so I did it with real data. Since I'm talking about risk over time, I wanted as much time, so I made big data trapezoids out of Schedule P. They start in accident year 79, which was the first year we kind of got into the Schedule P format that we're in today, fairly close anyway. And so they're all the way through 2006. Sorry, I just didn't get back to 2007's available. I just didn't get it in here in time. Okay, so I have a lot of accident years, but they're all truncated at 10, so it's a trapezoid. In my model, I didn't try to get into extrapolating past 10, and I don't have any useful exposure information. Just saw a presentation where somebody was telling me about this great database of rate changes for the whole industry that he tested, and they work really well. They only go back about 10 years. I could have created some online premiums, on-level premiums, and I would have had exposure information for the industry, but I didn't. Okay? I do workers' comp and GL, and I corrected both of these triangles for general inflation. I put together some indices, CPI, wage index, one for workers' comp, one for GL, slightly different indices, but actually fairly similar. So everything we're modeling is losses that have been detrended for general inflation. So we're looking for effects beyond general inflation. I did the paid outstanding model, as I said on the bottom, but I'm actually not going to show it to you. It came out about the same. Okay, the Kalman filter and parameter smoothing. I don't want to get into the math of it too much, but you're dividing losses by exposures. So we have some idea that these things might all be at the same level. And if they look like they're all at the same level and that's plausible, you're done. You've got one parameter, nice and parsimonious. And that is actually analogous to the Cape Cod method if you were not in the modeling world, really putting everything on one level. But sometimes your data just doesn't agree with you. You know, you look at the data and you say, it's just not plausible. Either my exposure measurement's imperfect. Perhaps there are some kind of frequency trend things acting on the accident year. They're not all at one level. Well, you can make the levels different. Then you have lots of parameters. Or you can go partway in between. You could say these parameters are related. They're not completely independent. The information from one accident year tells me something about the other information, but they're not exactly the same. And the idea of the way it works is that we say, okay, we have our data. We have our individual accident year observations, but they're embedded in noise. But underneath that noise, there is a true mean. And the true mean for every accident year isn't the same. It is the result of a time series. And it uses the absolute simplest time series there is, which is a random walk. It has one parameter, a variance. We call it in this context the adaptive variance. So it's saying that those accident year underlying parameters may be drifting through this random walk. And then there's an algorithm that you could solve for the parameters, telling it what the adaptive variance is. If you make the adaptive variance very high, you get independent parameters. If you make it zero, then you get one parameter, and then something in between. By the way, in the world of non-stochastic, I developed many, many years ago a non-stochastic analog to that. It's called the generalized Cape Cod method. They still use it at Milliman. And I've seen it a couple of other places, but many people have forgotten about it. But it's very handy. In any case, it didn't come up. Now I've given you all this as background because, as I said, I didn't have good exposure data. So these accident years didn't look like they were at the same level at all. So I didn't use it much. But it's a background because I'm going to use it in the next. So these are accident year levels from the industry workers' comp database, not divided by exposure, just divided by one. And the blue line just shows you that I've used the smoothing a tiny bit. But I didn't use it much because these things don't just look like they're randomly flying up and down. There is something going on here. The fact that they're horizontal in the long run is artificial. It has to do with the way I fit the model. I force them to have no trend. The trend gets overlaid into the calendar year direction. But basically, this is what happened in workers' comp. There was a huge buildup of losses, and then there was a huge decline in losses. Don't forget, these are losses. So we have a long-term sharp decline in workers' comp frequency over this time period. And also, there's been a problem depopulating of the industry. There might have been companies appearing and disappearing. So I couldn't use the smoothing much, so this is kind of like the chain ladder. I had to let every accident year find its own level because I didn't have good exposure information. That's what it looked like for GL. Look at those two patterns and how completely different they are in terms of the movement of on an accident year basis of workers' comp and GL when the losses were growing, when the losses were shrinking. They look very unrelated. That's on an accident year basis. Now let's talk to what I really came here to talk about, which is the calendar year, the all-important calendar year. So what I did, and I haven't seen this written up, is the Kalman filter makes this underlying assumption of the random walk, and I changed that slightly and said, let's make that time series, instead of a random walk, an AR1, or first-order autoregressive, and that just has two parameters. In addition to having a variance like a random walk, it also has another parameter, the autocorrelation coefficient. And for purposes of smoothing the parameters, you know what? It makes no difference at all. It's no help. Whether you use the row of 1, which is what the Kalman filter uses, or 0.9 or 0.8, it all comes about the same. In fact, I said if rho equals 1, then it is the random walk. So why bother? It doesn't really help. And the reason I went to the trouble is because I want a probabilistic description also of this calendar year process that I can extend into the future so I can do something to simulate the risk of future calendar year changes. And a random walk is just not considered a very good model for future inflation. It should be mean reverting in some sense, and that's the difference, is that the autoregressive model is mean reverting. So for forecasting, it's simply more plausible to use. For fitting, it comes out at the same. So now in the slides that follow, you're going to see that we did do a decent amount of smoothing in the calendar year direction, and let's just talk about it while we're looking at it. That's workers' comp. So now you can see that here there is noise in the data. You can see those points flying up and down a little bit. The smoothing coefficient, I moved it down, so now we're doing some real smoothing, but can't take that pattern out. That's just not, in the long run, these are calendar year trends, and you can see they're going up and down a lot, and a lot of that is not the random variation. By the way, when you fit with statistics, you get a variance-covariance matrix on the parameters, and if you let all the calendar years have individual parameters, and that's what the red dots are, as if you let every calendar year have its own trend, it is predicted and true that adjacent ones have a significant negative correlation. So it's why you get some of that wiggling up and down pattern that you see. But by smoothing, you can see that there is a real and meaningful pattern in this data. The absolute values are not could be a little confusing because we have that long-term negative frequency trend overlie. That's why the trend rates, if you thought of them as severity trends, you'd say that was awfully small. But at the peak of, which looks like around 1988, I got a number that looks like plus 5%. At the trough, 1996 or so, I got negative 5%. That's a 10% movement in annual inflation rate in the workers' comp line of business over that time period. 10% drop. And even though we're in a more stable environment, presumably, that negative 5 in 99, by the time you got to 2001, that was up to, it looks like, about negative 2. So we had a 3-point change. Now, if you take your reserves and impose an average of 3 points of difference of trend between what's implicit in there and what's going to really happen, that is a monstrous reserve error. 1 point is significant, 2 points gets really big. And of course, that would be an average trend for the whole period. So this future trend issue is very big, important, and trend is not stable over time. And that is, of course, if my blue line has picked out something that's really a trend and not just random variation. Looks like we found the trend. Did the same thing there for the GL. GL actually has a larger database, but far more unstable database. So you can see the underlying red points are much more all over the place. I had to use a stronger adaptation coefficient, but I think we seem to smooth it out there and find a smooth trend. Same kind of issues as we saw in workers' comp, that there's, over time, significant calendar year effects in that industry data. These are on the diagonal. Let's look at the two of them together. Wow. Think GL and workers' comp trends are correlated? These are from different triangles in the annual statement. Completely different triangles, went through that smoothing. It looks like we did a pretty good job finding the pattern and smoothing out the differences. Can't be a coincidence that those two lines have such an incredibly similar pattern of calendar year effects. Remember the accident year effects? Completely different worlds. Calendar year effects? Oh, my God. They look the same. So now we have to, how do we put this into the model, at least for forecast? How do we forecast this effect and what does it look like? So here's just a quick review of what an autoregressive one process looks like. And we model this as a process centered at zero. So we can think of it as a trend error process rather than the trend process. So there are these random variables X1, XI. They're independent of each other. They're mean zero normal variables, all have the same sigma. They're all drawn from the same distribution. And then so then the AR1 variable that's doing the random walk is called T1 through 2K. And you can say each one of them is just the last one times the autocorrelation coefficient plus the next random draw. And don't forget, all the random draws are zero. So these things may drift up and down, but they're not expected to move on the mean. Now, these are all in log scale, by the way. So I do this autoregressive process centered at zero. So what I'm calling a trend is in log scale. So if I have a trend of 5, what I'm saying, the trend factor is not 1 plus 0.05, but rather e to the 0.05. which looks a lot like 1 plus 0.05, except when the trends get large. So that's all the left part of the thing, showing how it's long normal. It doesn't become exactly mean zero when you exponentiate it that way. It has an upward bias. On the individual year, the upward bias is insignificant. But when you compound a bunch of years together, it can be significant in the long run. Any way you do trend error, even if I made them normal and added one, the compounding would create that same upward bias. I've left it in there. You can take it out if you want. I think it's real if you think about how trend works. Maybe symmetric in 1 year, but in the long run, a high trend error is worth more money than a low one. Okay, so basically these X things are the independent random variables, so those are the things we're going to simulate. And those, the X things in a given line of business, each one of them represents a different future calendar year, are independent of each other. Within any one future calendar year, the X for one line of business can be correlated to the X for another line of business, and that's what we're going to do. So what are our versions of X's? Well, let's look at these fitted. We think we've found the pattern underneath the noise. Let's look at these found patterns and see what those X's should look like. And what those X's should like are residuals from the AR1 process. Fairly easy to calculate them. First, let's call those observed trends. That means the smoothed ones. We call them TK. First, we want them to be mean zero. So I just took them all and subtracted the mean of all of them. So I get these small TKs that are mean zero. And then I take each one of the TKs and I subtract my rho, which we postulated at 0.8 in all the other exhibits. So I subtract 80% of the previous one, and that gives me the residuals that correspond and affect our observations of the XIs. So how do they look? Well, that's what they look like for GL and for workers' comp over the years. So the standard deviation of those residuals for GL happens to be 2%. The standard deviation of those residuals for workers' comp is 1.5%, and the correlation between them is 84%. That's pretty highly correlated trends. And so the last slide is, well, how does it all come out? Because now we're going to forecast this future trend error forward in time with this correlation, with these standard deviations, and what does it mean? So I end with a table. So let me just describe the table a little bit, what I mean by original. Okay, so now I have this whole stochastic model that I haven't described in great detail, and I do a bootstrapping process on it. And on the original, I just bootstrap it the way I would normally without this extra trend error. Now, that doesn't mean that I've got no error in for the uncertainty in calendar year trend, because the model forecasts a mean calendar year trend, and then through bootstrapping, there's a parameter error measurement about how you might have gotten that mean trend wrong. So this model has every bit as much CV in it as most of the other models. It's got the parameter risk and the process risk, and that's the CV of 4.6% that you see for the original GL model. What it doesn't have is this extra risk that says, well, it's not just that I got the parameter wrong, it's that even if I got the parameter right, the trend might change in the future because these future trends are volatile. And that's what this extra model is for. So when I put on the extra model, that CV goes from 4.6 to 7.2. So that risk of the future trend being wrong, AR1 model with a 2% annual standard deviation, is just about as big as all the other risks put together. Actually, it's probably bigger because the two things are not correlated with each other. So if you look at the CV of that process alone, it's bigger than 4.6 for the combined CV to be 7.2. Also, skewness, the original model, comes out, law of large numbers and central limit theorem and all, probably comes out fairly normal looking in the aggregate distribution. You see the skewness came out close to zero. But this log normal walk in the future of the future trend creates a lot of variance and it creates skewness. Although 26% skewness is not enormous. Then I also showed how the percentiles move. Do the same thing for workers' comp triangle. Interestingly enough, because it was a stable triangle, that the CV, original CV, actually came out a bit higher because random instability doesn't matter that much. It's how stable the trends are. And I guess that they came out a little less. Here the AR1 is a little less. We only had a 1.5% rather than a 2% annual standard deviation. The tail may be shorter also. None of these things have extended tails. This is just a payout of the reserves out to 10 years, stopping right there. Again, the AR1 process, it goes out into the future. The longer the tail you put in, the bigger and bigger it gets. It makes sense. Anybody tells you that they can project a payment that's going to be made 20 years from now with anything other than a huge CV, they must be living in a world that's different from the world I live in. I don't know what's going to happen 20 years from now. Okay, now you put the two together. Well, what do you see? The 4.6 went to 7.2 for GL, 5.7 went to 6.7 for workers' comp, and 3.7 goes to 6.1 for combined, because the original part of the models is the part of the risk that's uncorrelated, and that future trend risk is the part that is highly correlated. So when you put lines of business together, the correlation starts to drive everything, and the correlated risk more and more becomes the dominant part. So I think part of this talk about correlation is, as was told to you in the first talk, you could somehow, you have to estimate it. You can think of overall correlation, but you can also think, as Glenn talked about, it's the factors that cause correlation. So here we've kind of broken it up and say, I've got all the things that fit in your regular model, and if that fits, there really shouldn't be cross lines correlation once you've fitted it out and looked at the residuals. And then you've got the common driver. What's common in these two models? And the most obvious common driver is calendar year trend. And when I measured that in industry database for GL and workers' comp, I got a tremendously high correlation that couldn't have been a coincidence. And so that's what I think the key of it. Really, to me, I think future risk and calendar year trend is the big risk of our industry for the law on the loss reserve side. It's what makes risk dynamic. You know, nobody in a financial world would fit a model by taking a line, fitting it, and saying the error is that I might have gotten the slope of the line wrong. They use time series, because time series gets the idea of that there's a trend, there's risk that is related to time. And we have these static models, and the calendar year, the future is different from the past. It's just not in the models. Time is not in the models. Time is the real risk. It's what and that's where the correlation lies as well. It's what I've believed, and certainly this exercise on industry data seems to bear it out. I think that's my last slide. Thank you. We have 5 minutes, 10 minutes, if anybody has anything to say to any of the presenters. Thank you for your time.
Okay. I got a question. When you put together all those Schedule P's, did you have problems with companies changing